Welcome to Women in the Arena podcast, the podcast celebrating women doing extraordinary things in plain sight. I'm your host, Audra Egan, and our mission is to elevate the value, strength, and resilience each woman brings to the world. Without further delay, let's go ahead and start the show. Welcome in, everyone, and thank you so much for being with me again this week. This week, I am with an incredible, brave, and brilliant woman. I'm with Dr. Adia Harvey Wingfield, and she is a leading sociologist, and she is a celebrated author who concentrates her research on racial and gender inequality in professional settings. This is a big topic, and she has done quite a bit of research. Her new book, Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. It is focusing not just on the problem, but on the solution. It is my pleasure and my honor to introduce to you Dr. Adia Harvey Wingfield. Adia, thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
First of all, what a big topic. And what an important topic. What compelled you to tackle such a complex and charged topic, which is something that is necessary, but like I said in the beginning, is very brave to tackle?
Thank you. That's a great question. Since I was a graduate student, I've been researching different aspects of Black professionals at work. So this book is really a continuation in a career where I've been focused on different aspects of this question over the past couple decades. And I guess what made me want to think about the work in this context and in terms of how I present it in the book really stems from thinking a lot about how we, at this point in time, have this multi-billion dollar diversity industry with a B, right? We spend a lot of money. There's a lot of time and attention that companies, leaders, and often everyday people spend thinking about how work can be more diverse and diversity in the workplace in general and diversity and inclusion writ large. But at the same time, we know that we don't always necessarily see much progress. Black workers face substantial discrimination at the hiring level. They often stall out at middle levels of companies, and they're underrepresented in leadership in most organizations. So I wanted to understand why both of those things are happening. And I wanted to look at Black workers who are living through these experiences in work to try to understand how we can have such a focus on diversity, yet see so little of it actually accomplished in most of our companies today.
Why do you think that is? I mean, first of all, I did not understand that the spend was in the billions. That's pretty significant. So if we're spending so much money, why aren't we accomplishing so much? Is it, or we aren't doing it right? Or is it just marketing?
So I think it's some of both, but a lot of what I focus on is what I talk about in the book, this idea of the gray areas of work. And what I mean by that is that when we think about work, often we think about just the core basic aspects of our job. So I work as a college professor. My job is research, teaching, service, sometimes a whole lot of service. But ultimately, those are supposed to be the core parts of my job. But that doesn't encompass a lot of the other aspects of how we work. It doesn't encompass how I found out about the job that I have, or how I found out about jobs, or the connections that I have to make in order to get access to jobs in the first place. It doesn't include the organizational culture in my university and how that organizational culture can have an impact on my ability to thrive or not thrive at work. And it doesn't take into consideration the processes by which people advance, which often aren't necessarily exclusively connected to the work that they're doing. So those things, the social, the cultural, the relational parts of work, those are what I identify as the gray areas. And those are the areas that I think are where we're ripe for seeing racial inequality perpetuated in our workplaces, because those areas are more ambiguous, they're a little bit more murky, and they aren't really targeted by policy or organizational mandates in many cases.
Well, since you mentioned that you are a college professor, and we're spending all this money in corporations, maybe we're not spending it all in the right place. Maybe it needs to start shifting into the educational system to help teaching and guiding and mentoring earlier in the first place. What is your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly helps. And when we talk about workplaces and where we can allocate resources, one of the things that we also know from research is that often resources are not allocated into the areas that have shown the most success, right? So I talk in the book about mandated diversity trainings, for example, and how many companies rely on mandating diversity trainings because they're so popular. It's a big part of this industry, and it just seems like the thing to do. But we also know from extensive research that mandating diversity training does not work. It does not improve the numbers of Black workers in leadership. It actually can depress the numbers of Black workers in leadership, and it can contribute to backlash on a number of different fronts. But we don't necessarily see the inability to succeed and make changes reflected in how many organizations rely on diversity training. So I think there's some truth to this idea that companies are not always allocating resources in the ways that are most efficacious. And that's something that I hope the book clarifies and highlights in terms of what the areas really are where Black workers are facing these gray areas and sometimes struggling.
So in your perspective, why do you think diversity training isn't working, or in a lot of cases is having the opposite effect?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So what we know from research is that when diversity trainings are mandated, there's multiple ways that workers balk and rebel. For white workers, mandated diversity trainings can make them feel blamed. They feel as if they are being castigated for something that they may or may not be doing. And it causes them to feel resentful and to shut down and to be less open to learning more about issues of race and racial inequality at work. And perhaps surprisingly for some listeners, my own research has also shown that for Black workers, they often maybe paradoxically respond somewhat similarly to mandated diversity trainings. And the reasons for that are that for Black workers, when companies mandate this work, often it feels more like an exercise in regulatory compliance and less like the company is genuinely motivated to try to understand the depths and the nuance of the experiences and the challenges that they face in the workplace. So what we end up having are companies that are mandating these initiatives and multiple sets of workers not engaging and not responding in ways that actually lead to change.
That's a really interesting perspective. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but what you're saying, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that it feels very disingenuous and checking the box.
Yep. Exactly. That phrase of checking the box is exactly what I have heard from many Black workers who talk about why they often react so negatively to diversity training, because it doesn't address some of the challenges that I talk about in gray areas in terms of the difficulties getting hired and the difficulties managing organizational culture that can seem inhospitable, the challenges that are associated with forming the relationships that are necessary for advancement. Often those things are not covered in diversity training. And so for Black workers, they just feel like, here we go again. I'm checking this box so that the organization can say that they care, but I know that they don't because they're not addressing the things that really are impacting me.
So I'm a big believer in a rising tide floats all boats. And organizations are already spending the money. Why not take that money and spend it in a more thoughtful way? Because now it no longer becomes just about a diversity spend, but an investment spend.
Right.
And that means that it brings opportunity for everybody and maybe not seem so isolating or deliberate or whatever the interpretations are that those people that are receiving this training are feeling. So if your research, how would you recommend they spend their money wisely? How do they reallocate it so then it actually makes impact rather than, oh, here we go again?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that I like about that question is that there's actually a pretty decent amount of data and research that does document things that companies can do differently and do successfully. So just as a couple of examples, we know that when companies establish mentoring programs and open those mentoring programs to everybody, rather than making them invitation only or just letting mentoring happen organically, then we actually are more likely to see Black workers sign up for those programs, and we're actually more likely to see them move into leadership positions. And the reason for that, again, is that when everybody's allowed access to a mentoring program, mentors may connect with mentees that they otherwise would not work with, but then they also become more familiar with and more aware of the wealth of talent across the organization. And, you know, humans are creatures who are self-invested in many ways. People want to see their mentees do well. That reflects well on you if your mentee is successful. But when these programs are left to invitation only, or when they are only allowed to form organically, it's a lot more easy for Black workers to be overlooked than if the programs are open to all. So Mentoring for All is recommended by the research and documented to show positive effects in the literature. Another suggestion that can actually replace mandated diversity trainings is for companies to institute diversity task forces instead, particularly when those task forces draw from people at multiple levels of the organization and pull together people to identify and create solutions. And the creating solutions part is really important for that, because you'll remember that I said a minute ago, with mandated diversity trainings, workers, particularly white workers, often feel as if they are being blamed. But when people throughout the organization are coming together and they're being told, okay, let's identify what the problems are and let's fix those problems, that gives everybody a stake in being part of the solution. And people respond better to being part of the solution than they do than just being blamed or being feeling as if they are being blamed for a problem.
Do you have any real life examples of task force that have been put into place in organizations that you have consulted with, or maybe even in your own university?
So not so much in terms of organizations that I've consulted with, but in the book, I do talk about different examples, different kind of real world examples, so which have, to be fair, met with varying degrees of success. So in the conclusion, I cite examples from Google, from Coca-Cola, and from GV, a venture capital firm. And I talk about the ways that those companies in the real world have tried to address some of these issues related to hiring, to organizational culture, and to advancement, again, with varying degrees of success with their outcomes. But it's important to highlight the ways that companies are grappling with this, because again, the data do show that there are certain steps that companies can take that are going to be a lot more successful and more likely to yield results than the going back over the things that may seem popular and commonplace, but aren't necessarily creating the change that companies say they want to see.
Well, having degrees of varying degrees of success is not a failure, in my opinion. It's a trial. Mm-hmm. Which means that this is something completely different. So you're not going to do it great right out of the gate. It's going to be something that you have to try over and over again until you get it right. Mm-hmm. But knowing that, is it still worth the investment?
Yes. I mean, I think when we're talking about this question of diversity and inclusion in companies, to me, at this point, this isn't a can we or should we? It's a we have to. This is an imperative, right? And the reason that I say that again is that we have a society that's increasingly becoming more and more multiracial and more diverse. We do not currently, for the most part, have companies that reflect that diversity. So it's hard for me to see how companies prepare to be competitive in a global 21st century economy, global 21st century economy that's increasingly multiracial if they are not prepared to meet the needs of an increasingly multiracial workforce and consumer base. And to me, it just seems that in order to do that, companies have to be prepared to acknowledge and reflect the fact that the world is more racially diverse, the workforce is more racially diverse, and companies have to be prepared to think about what that means and how they want to change to be prepared to deal with that reality.
I know that it's a difficult message to get across because we have inherited a tradition. I mean, we just have. I mean, I can't even sugarcoat it. That's what's happened. And it's difficult to convince them of otherwise, that when you start to embrace other people's ideas that may be different from yours, that that's better for everybody. It doesn't necessarily mean that you lose something. It may mean that your something may change, but it isn't necessarily any worse. It just looks different. In a lot of cases, it looks better. But how do we get that message across? Because it is fighting a traditional system that no longer works. We all identify that it no longer works. But the difficulty is in the message and then the actual implementation.
Right.
How do we do that?
Right. So one of the things that I talk about early in the book is how historically we have had this really intimate connection between race and labor, where work has often been kind of this dividing line. It's been a way of separating different racial groups, and it's been a way of establishing who belongs in certain jobs and who doesn't belong in certain jobs. And it's been a way of excluding Black workers from jobs that were the most secure, the most high paying, the most high status and likely to establish long-term economic security. And I think one of the consequences of that is that we've come to see access to work and work itself as kind of this zero-sum game in the way that you're describing, right? So if other people are being allowed in, then somehow I'm losing. And that's a mindset that we've had about work for a long time. That's one mindset, right? But another way that we can think about work is how enormously wasteful it actually is to have a society where there is significant ongoing extensive racial and gender discrimination. So I'll give you a statistic. I read a citation from a study from the San Francisco Federal Reserve Board from about 2 years ago that noted that eliminating racial and gender inequality in the workplace would boost the U.S. economy by over $2 trillion. Trillion. Not million, not billion, over $2 trillion. And I think numbers like those are staggering for a couple of reasons. They highlight just how rampant, systemic, and wide-ranging these issues are, but they also highlight just how much waste is part of a system that does include racial and gender discrimination and inequality. And that waste is economic, as evidenced in the numbers, but it's also waste on the level of human capital, because we have so many people who could be poised to contribute better to our society, to our institutions, to our companies, and to our organizations, who are being denied opportunities because of the way that we have structured work. And so my hope is that with gray areas and having people think more about how these gray areas perpetuate some of these inequalities, that this gets us to different ways of thinking about work and how we could all be contributing in better and different ways.
So as an individual, because making corporations start thinking differently about their operations is going to take a little bit longer. But you cannot argue with, did you say $3 trillion?
Over $2 trillion. So about $2.1 or $2 trillion.
Yeah. $2 trillion. You cannot argue with that, because corporations, if nothing else, they're about the bottom line.
Right.
Over $2 trillion, that says something. But it also will take a while.
Right.
But I'm also a firm believer that if you want to change the world, then it has to start with you.
Right.
So how do we as individuals, and because my audience is predominantly women, and let's face it, if the world's going to change, it's going to start with us, period. That's just going to happen. How do we start to make that change in our organizations? In small, big, medium, doesn't matter. How do we
do it? That's a great question too. And I think there are three things that I recommend to kind of everyday people who might be listeners who are working and thinking, like you said, what could I do to make my workplace differently? And these things correlate to the sections that I have in the book. So in the book, I talk about hiring, organizational culture, and advancement. When it comes to hiring, I think it's really critical to be a reference and to be a resource. We know that, like I said, there's substantial hiring discrimination that still occurs. And a big part of how we see that persist is that most people today find jobs through their connections and their existing social networks. But we also know that networks are pretty racially homogenous. Most people don't have very racially integrated networks, and that becomes a way that racial inequalities persist through the hiring process. But that doesn't have to be the case. So the first thing I would suggest is that people diversify their networks and then actively make it a point to recruit Black workers, to reference and suggest Black workers for certain jobs. The second thing that I would suggest has to do with organizational culture. And I would advocate there for people to be an ally and to speak up. And that can include speaking up in support of a company's efforts to diversify. But equally important, it can also include speaking up when people are faced with negative statements and downplaying of the organization's efforts to diversify. And that is something that my respondents talk about and that I try to document in gray areas. Everyone's not on board with this question of more diversity. Sometimes people will say openly that they're not on board. And that type of statement and that type of public feedback can have a real chilling and dampening effect on Black workers and people who are in favor. So I'd suggest being an ally and speaking up in support of diversity and speaking out when people are denigrating it. And then the third point that I would suggest is related to advancement. And there I would say that it's really critical to be a sponsor. We know that Black workers are less likely to report having close relationships with or being on the radar of their managers and supervisors. This is a thing that people can do in the workplace. You can make it a point to be a sponsor, to be a mentor, to work closely with potential up-and-coming workers in the organization, and to really actively try to support the next generation of Black leadership. And these are things that anybody can do. These aren't necessarily larger things that have to be organizational policy, but these are things that everyday workers can try to do to address the gray areas that I talk about.
I believe one person can change the world.
Absolutely.
And I know you do too, which is why you wrote the book.
Yes.
As always, I promise your producers and your editors that I will run on time. So before we run out of time, I'd like to give you the opportunity to let the audience know where they can reach you and where they can find your book.
Sure. So the book is available anywhere books are sold. It is officially out today, which is really exciting. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Anywhere you buy books, you can find Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. For people interested in finding me, I'm on Facebook at Adia Wingfield, and I am on X as Adia H. Wingfield. So you can find me at either of those social media sites.
I will make sure that all of those links are in the show notes, and so everybody can access you, ask you questions, and get to know a little bit more about what we can do as individuals to contribute to society to make everybody's lives better.
Absolutely.
Including our own.
Absolutely.
So this is my favorite part of the show, where I step back from the mic and I give you an opportunity to have an intimate moment directly with the audience without me interrupting. So the mic is yours.
Okay. So I would just first thank everybody for listening and say that I hope that people are able to have a chance to take a look at the book, and hopefully it speaks to and reflects your own experiences, and also hopefully inspires people to think about how we can restructure workplaces and make organizations different and more functional for everybody.
Thank you. And first of all, thank you again for writing this book. It was very brave.
Thank you.
It was needed. And it'll help change the world. So thank you for that. And thank you for being here. I really enjoyed our conversation. And I hope to continue to have more conversations like this, broader conversations like this, so we can really deep dive and pull back some of these layers of these things that we've inherited that no longer fit us.
Absolutely.
So thank you for being here very much.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
And I want to thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you again next time. This is just the beginning. That's our show. I am so grateful for each and every one of you and your unwavering support and your continued belief in this movement that has become much bigger than me, much bigger than just a podcast. It has become this forward momentum that we are all doing together. If you are ready, or you know somebody that is ready to tell your story and share your value with the world, please connect with me. You can reach me at audra@womeninthearena.net. I am so honored and thankful that you will share your story with me, and I'll make sure that it is well taken care of. I will never stop thanking each and every one of you, and I cannot wait to talk to you again next week as we share another woman's story and we celebrate her doing extraordinary things in plain sight. We'll see you next time.